101 days into the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip, the death toll is 24,100, mainly women and children. Despite more than 3 months of killing and destruction of Palestinians, Israel has failed to achieve any of its declared objectives of removing Hamas or releasing captives. Israeli occupation forces raid several areas in the West Bank, killing at least 5 Palestinians and detaining dozens. Hey everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Shafiq. Good to have you with us. Israel's pushing ahead with its deadly campaign of bombings and raids in Gaza, 101 days into the onslaught. The regime's latest attacks have claimed the lives of at least 45 more Palestinians in Gaza. 33 civilians were killed in a raid on residential buildings in the early hours of Monday. Another 12 were killed in an attack in eastern Gaza Strip. The death toll from the Israeli genocide has already surpassed the 24,000 mark. Also, the civilian infrastructure has sustained extensive damage as a result of the regime's relentless bombing and shelling. Latest figures show nearly 100 schools and universities and more than 140 mosques in Gaza have been completely destroyed. That's besides more than 80 hospitals and health centers that are already out of service. The military wing of Palestine's Islamic Jihad has released new footage showing the targeting and killing of an Israeli trooper in Gaza. The video shows an Al-Quds Brigade sniper shooting the trooper in Khan Yunus. The regime has yet to confirm that incident. The military wing of Hamas movement also says its fighters targeted the occupation forces in Khan Yunus with mortar shells. According to Al-Ghassan Brigades, the attack left a number of casualties. Israel has admitted the death of nearly 190 of its forces in the Gaza Strip since the beginning of its ground invasion. Resistance groups in the territory say that Israel is underreporting its casualties. According to Israeli media, some 4,000 forces have also suffered disabilities since the 7th of October. Charlotte Cates, who is with the Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network in Canada, says that Israel has been unable to achieve its announced goals in Gaza.
The occupation has been unable to break the will of the Palestinian people or destroy the resistance. It has also taken a tremendous human cost from people because the occupation's attacks have been directed against the civilian population as a whole. They've targeted hospitals, schools, residential buildings, mosques, churches. I mean, the purpose of the occupation's attacks, and they're very explicit about this. And this, of course, was also brought up before the International Court of Justice in just the past several days in South Africa's case, is that the purpose of these attacks was to cause the greatest damage possible to the Palestinian civilian population. And unfortunately, this comes as no surprise because this has always been the purpose and the goal of the Zionist movement and the Zionist entity in occupied Palestine since 1948 and before. And we're seeing them continue to attempt to carry out the same project of dispossession, displacement, targeting the Palestinian people as a whole, that they have been doing for over 75 years with the full support and complicity of the United States, Canada, Germany, Britain, and other European powers, all of which are fully responsible and must be held accountable for this ongoing genocide.
A European NGO says at least 100,000 Palestinians have been killed, wounded, or reported missing in the Israeli recurring air and artillery strikes on Gaza. According to Euromed Human Rights Monitor, over 90% of those killed are civilians, mostly women and children. Hundreds of health personnel are also among the victims. The NGO says that the Israeli attacks have caused long-term disabilities in a number of injured people. It added that hundreds of people have sustained critical injuries. Israel is trying to prevent journalists from broadcasting the truth about its atrocities against Palestinians. It even kills them to stop them from covering the facts on the ground. That according to Palestinian Journalists Syndicate. It says that more than 110 journalists, including 14 women, have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. It described the killings as intentional, warning against the regime's attempts to fabricate and falsify charges against journalists. The syndicate says that the charges can be leveled to justify the regime's murder of journalists. It vowed that it will continue efforts to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its crimes against journalists. The meantime, reports of Israeli forces stealing money from the Palestinians' homes at the raid in the West Bank have added a new dimension to the atrocities the regime is committing against Palestinians. According to Palestinian media, there is footage that shows Israeli troopers stealing cash. The video is made in a residential building in Ramallah. Since the 7th of October, some other footage of Israeli forces stealing Palestinian property have been released on several occasions. These are in addition to reports by Palestinians on the theft of their money, gold, and other valuables by Israeli troopers. The reports have triggered warnings by rights groups of systematic theft in civilian homes in Gaza and the West Bank. The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement has stressed Hezbollah's preparedness to confront Israel in case of an attack by the regime.
We've been ready for war. We're not afraid of war. We don't fear war. We won't hesitate in such a war. And we will go to such a war. And as I said, we will fight without any constraints, without any ceiling, without any limit, boundaries.
Saad Nasrallah said that Israel has been trying to cover up its failures in Gaza. After 100 days of onslaught, Israel has failed to achieve any of its goals. He hailed the Palestinian resistance for dealing heavy blows to the Israeli military. Nasrallah said that Tel Aviv undercounts its casualties due to the pressure from the public. He said Israelis have acknowledged that the regime's military is caught in a quagmire in Gaza, so they're calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Israeli forces have killed five more Palestinians in fresh raids in the West Bank. A trooper shot a teenager in the chest at a refugee camp near the city of Ariha or Jericho. Two teens were also killed in an area near Ramallah. The other killings took place near the city of Al-Khalil, where the regime's military fatally shot two Palestinian youths. Israeli forces also raided a university in Nablus, arresting 25 students there. Israel's intensified deadly raids across the West Bank since the beginning of its genocidal war on Gaza. Over the past 100 days, more than 340 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. In the same period, the regime's also abducted hundreds of Palestinians there. Ramallah correspondent Mona Kendall joined us a while ago with the latest regarding the Israeli raids in the occupied West Bank.
Every day the Israelis are raiding Palestinian areas. They are storming Palestinian areas. As you have said, the Israeli military raided the city of Nablus, and they, stormed the University of Al-Najah. Dozens of Palestinians had been protesting or staging a sit-in inside the Al-Najah Hospital, Al-Najah University. And the Israelis stormed the complex of Al-Najah and detained a number of Palestinians. It's not clear how many Palestinians had been detained because the operation, Israeli forces are still raiding the city of Nablus. But we can say initially, according to the president of the university, that we are speaking about 20 to 25 Palestinians, students, of course, had been detained in the city, in the University of Al-Najah. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, the Israeli military raids had targeted several areas. In the village of Kober, Israeli forces raided this village of Kober, and they stormed a number of houses. One of these houses is the house of Palestinian prisoner Nail al-Barghouti, who had been behind the bars for even over 40 years, and the Israelis conducted an arrest raid not only in Kober, in the village of Bitin, in Qalqilia, Ariha, as well as in Tulkarem.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out fresh attacks on U.S. positions in both Iraq and Syria. the group confirming launching drone and missile attacks on three American bases. It says that the strikes on the occupation troops in Iraq and Syria are in response to Washington's support for Tel Aviv's crimes against residents of Gaza. The resistance groups already hit Israeli military bases across the occupied territories. It says that it will continue targeting interests and bases of the U.S. until the Israeli genocide in Gaza ends. Now, on the 100th day of Israeli onslaught on Gaza, protest rallies have been held in several cities across Pakistan in solidarity with Palestinians. Protesters demand the International Court of Justice hold Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. Similar rallies were also held in other parts of the world.
In a powerful display of solidarity and condemnation, thousands of Pakistanis took to the streets in the port city of Karachi to protest against Israeli atrocities in Gaza. The protest, dubbed the Million Man March for Gaza, saw demonstrators from various walks of life voicing their anger at the Israeli regime and demanding an end to the violence that has engulfed the region for weeks. The march witnessed massive turnouts with protesters chanting slogans to condemn the Israeli massacre in Gaza. Simultaneously, civil society activists and Palestinian students studying at Pakistani universities also held protest demonstrations in solidarity with people of Gaza, praising South Africa for taking a bold step by filing a case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The protesters called on other nations to support South Africa's initiative and urged the International Court of Justice to conduct a thorough investigation into alleged atrocities committed by Israeli forces in Gaza.
The demonstrations for Gaza highlight a widespread sentiment among Pakistanis against unwavering support from the U.S. and its Western allies for Israel's actions in the region. These marches provide a platform for Pakistanis to vocally condemn Israeli forces for their atrocities against Palestinian population. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza is ongoing. So is the public campaign to try and stop it. Organizers say 500,000, many of them young people, from across the UK, descended upon the capital, London, to push the government to act on their demands. The march comes hot on the heels of US-UK strikes on Yemen, and a day after the International Court of Justice heard a landmark genocide case against Israel brought by South Africa, a case the UK government did not support.
UK governments for decades have been complicit in failing to hold Israel to account and thereby supporting the sustenance of his system of apartheid. But this is a particularly egregious episode in that history of complicity, because what we are complicit with now is a genocide.
Among the diverse crowd, healthcare professionals who know all too well the impact of the relentless U.S.-Israeli bombardment of the civilian infrastructure in Gaza.
I think what we're seeing is a systematic targeting of the healthcare system in Gaza Strip. And in fact, the entire infrastructure and supply of things that are needed to keep a population alive. If you just think about you, for example, and what you need to stay alive, you need water, you need food, you need shelter. Depending on, you know, your living situation, you need electricity. And if you're unwell, you need a hospital, and those are all the things that have been systematically targeted.
What's striking about this protest, as with the previous ones, is not just its sheer size, but also its youthfulness. Young men and women energized by the knowledge that the pressure that they have brought to bear over the past 3 months can contribute to a change in the policy of the British government on the ongoing Israeli massacre of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
This is the first national pro-Palestine demonstration of the year. Organizers say as long as the bloodshed in Gaza continues, so will their campaign. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Saturday, thousands of people took to the streets of the Italian capital to stage a rally in support of Gaza and the Palestinians The initiative, dubbed Stop the Genocide of Palestinians, was joined by a string of organizations representing social partners, including base unions and humanitarian associations, and people from all walks of life. Many at the rally stressed the importance of South Africa's submission to the International Court of Justice, accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza.
Although the ICJ is notoriously biased, it is important that a country that has suffered apartheid for decades, like South Africa, has filed a genocide case against Israel.
It's a new Nakba. We have already seen tens of thousands of displaced Gazans. Sadly, history repeats itself.
So far, the Italian government has unrelentingly sided with the Israeli regime. This despite hundreds of pro-Palestine demonstrations across Italy over the past months. On January the 1st, Italy began its one-year presidency of the Group of Seven major industrialized powers. Earlier this week, the Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani said that G7 members are working with the Israeli regime to secure a rapid end to Tel Aviv's onslaught in Gaza and reduce the civilian casualties.
My long militancy on the side of the Palestinians has taught me not to trust words, only actions matter. Let's wait and see. It could just be a mere propaganda strategy by the Italian government.
On Saturday, besides Rome rally, a dozen more demonstrations in solidarity with Palestinians were also held in many other Italian cities, including Milan, Turin, Florence, Genoa, and Pisa. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's ongoing genocidal assault on Palestinian civilians in Gaza is part of a long and brutal history that goes back to 1951. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, "The United States, the EU, and the UK do not tire of defending the Zionist regime's genocidal war against the Palestinian people with the cliché incantation that Israel has the right to defend itself. In August 2022, the Zionist regime bombed Palestinians in Gaza over 3 days, killing 49 people, including 17 children. The U.S. and the EU's response to the massacre was to declare emphatically their support for Israel's right to defend itself and mutedly to regret the death of Palestinian civilians. That was the last major massacre the Zionist regime committed in Gaza before its current genocidal war, but it certainly was not the first. For that, we must go back to 1951, when the Zionist regime began to raid the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime had already expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to Gaza between the end of 1947 and the summer of 1950, when the remaining 2,500 Palestinians from the Mediterranean town of Majdal Ascalon were loaded on 2 trucks by the Zionist regime's army. The fabricated regime of Israel would also expel 7,000 Palestinian Bedouins to Egypt during this period up to 1955. In October 1951, the Israelis raided Gaza, killing dozens of Palestinians and Egyptians, demolishing dozens of houses and blowing up wells to curb the attempts by the expelled Palestinians to return home across new borders erected by the Jewish settler colony. Earlier in August 1949, Israeli troops captured 2 Palestinian refugees. They killed the man, and 22 troops took turns raping the woman before killing her. In March 1950, the Zionist regime troops abducted 2 Palestinian girls and 1 boy from Gaza across the new border. They killed the boy and then raped the 2 girls before killing them. By then, it was quite common for the Zionist regime troops and police to rape female Palestinian refugees attempting to return to their homes, a practice that was widespread during the Nakba a few years earlier. In August 1950, for example, 4 Zionist policemen raped a Palestinian woman picking fruit from her family's orchard across the West Bank border. The Zionist regime raids on Gaza would continue in 1952 and 1953, culminating in the Boragi refugee camp massacre in August of that year. The Zionist regime's military unit 101 killed at least 20 Palestinian refugees, including 7 women and 5 children, by throwing bombs through the windows of their huts while they slept and shooting those who fled. Dozens were injured. Other sources put the final tally of Palestinians killed at 50. At the time, foreign observers did not mention the Zionist regime's right to defend itself and called the massacre an appalling case of deliberate mass murder. That same year, the Israelis slaughtered 70 Palestinian civilians in the West Bank village of Gibeah, which even the Indianapolis-based pro-Israel National Jewish Post compared to the Nazi massacre. In February 1955, the Israelis raided an Egyptian military camp in Gaza, killing at least 36 Egyptian troops and 2 Palestinian civilians, one of whom was a child. The Zionists bombed the Gaza city of Khan Yunis on November 2, 1956, from the air, killing scores of civilians before Zionist tanks entered the city on November 3. The Israelis rounded up resistance fighters and executed them on the spot or in their homes. Meanwhile, in the adjacent refugee camp, the Zionists rounded up all men and boys above the age of 15 in the town square. They proceeded to machine gun them, killing between 300 and 500 people, the vast majority of whom were civilians and half being 1948 refugees. They occupied Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula until they were forced out by the U.S. and the USSR in March 1957. In the past few weeks, the Zionist regime carried out massacres in Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, which the Zionist regime dubbed a dangerous combat zone after it had served as a safe zone for 1 million Palestinians who had fled northern Gaza. It included the slaughter of 30 civilians sheltering at a school from the Zionist regime's savage bombings. The relentless mass killing of Palestinians since October 7th makes the 1956 savage Israeli regime massacres seem humane in comparison. In 1967, the Zionist regime again invaded and occupied Gaza. It expelled 75,000 Palestinians from the Strip and prevented 50,000 more who were working, studying, or traveling outside Gaza when the Zionist regime invaded from returning home. It confiscated 60% of the land and all the water of the Palestinians, much of which was for the exclusive use of the Jewish colonists, who had access to 18 times the amount of water available to the indigenous Palestinians. The Jewish colonists had 85 more stolen land per capita than the Palestinian owners of the land. The fabricated regime of Israel subjected the entire Palestinian population to a racialized military occupation, during which it destroyed Gaza's economic infrastructure until 2005. Since the Zionist regime's redeployment around Gaza in September 2005 and its incarceration of 2.3 million Palestinians in the Gaza concentration camp, the Israelis launched numerous bombing campaigns against the camp's civilian inmates and the resistance, including in 2006, 2008 to 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021, killing thousands of civilians. The only victory that the Zionist regime's military has scored since October 7th is the slaughter of tens of thousands of civilians, with tens of thousands more injured, and more than 2 million others displaced. It has further succeeded in the destruction of homes and residential buildings, hospitals, schools, libraries, municipal buildings, churches, and mosques. Despite all the civilian slaughter and destruction, its reputation for military preparedness has been lost for the foreseeable future. As more and more details trickle out of the Zionist regime's murder of its own civilians and destruction of their homes on October 7th, it will be a long time before it can recapture some of the fictional military allure it has previously enjoyed in the West and among its Arab allies. One of the more interesting ironies of the current Zionist regime's war is that, whereas the U.S. empire and its EU and UK subsidiaries continue to rearm the Zionist regime since October 8, without respite so that the settler colony could continue its genocidal war, it is the Palestinian resistance that has had no weapons replenishment since that date and yet continues to score military victories against the Zionist regime's invaders. But not only have the Americans been the major party to this war against a colonized and brutalized people, Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, went further by identifying the United States with the Zionist regime so much that he referred to the Palestinian resistance as the enemy of the United States. Given the shameless racist discourse among Zionist regime's officials about the Palestinians as animals and subhuman, the extraordinary force of the indiscriminate Israeli killing machine and the scale of the Zionist regime's genocidal atrocities, the appropriateness or inappropriateness of the analogy is up for debate. What remains beyond doubt, however, is that while the industrial scale of Israeli regime atrocities in Gaza is unprecedented, their cruel nature has been part and parcel of the Zionist regime's war on the Palestinian people since 1948.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide to managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. I extend my sincere condolences to the Islamic Ummah on the martyrdom of Imam Hadi alayhi salam, who lived a very fruitful life, though his life was short, but he lived a fruitful life of guidance and submissiveness to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we pray that on this day we get attention from the divine sources so that we can be able to focus in our activities and understand the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam in a more profound manner. We were discussing the letter of Malik Ashtar, and we are trying to receive some, you can say, intuition and guidance from this letter so that we can be assisted in our managerial activities, especially those who have any leadership position and managers. And we are trying to understand certain points and certain areas where we need to focus in an Islamic manner that inshallah we shall work on in the coming segment.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, in the previous session, we said that Imam Ali alayhi salam in this letter tells Malik Ashtar, ثُمَّ انظُرْ فِي أُمُورِ عُمَّالِكَ, that, O Malik, look into and scrutinize the affairs of those who work under you. That means be careful about human resources. Like look into them, gauge them, take care of them. All of these things, like take this issue seriously. one of the very important aspects of managing is the human resources that are working with you. And then he tells him, فَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا, that make use of them. Take their help. اِخْتِبَارًا, through examination. You should be examining them, testing them. That means do not just accept people just for some whimsical reasons. You know, you have a position today. Okay, let's say the head of the educational department, let's say. But you choose someone who has zero experience in education or has some experience in the medical field. That's an absolutely, wrong choice. You need someone who has got experience in education, someone who has worked, someone who has studied himself, who has gone through a system of education. Well, fortunately, sometimes you see in some countries that you have the minister, let's say, of health, but he doesn't have any idea about how hospitals run, how they work. I mean, you know, this is a very big problem. In some countries, of course, many of the countries have changed their approach. But I'm not talking about a country, even at small, in a small scale managing facility, we need to be careful that when we choose someone, we choose them ikhtibaran. Now, when we talk about tests or examining, it's not just about their expertise, but it's also about their abilities, the other abilities that they have, their potentials, right? Their character, the type of character they have, and most importantly is their piety. Because even if everyone has all of these other characteristics, but they are not pious, then they might misuse those abilities. But the guarantee for that expertise and that good quality to be used in the right way is the piety. So we need to have this approach that we have these ways we can test people and find out these characteristics within them and make use of them in the society.
IRIB English Radio presents a detailed commentary of the Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, on the program Gate of Knowledge.
Now, when we say that فَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا, someone might feel, okay, so this is referring to when you want to choose someone in the start. For example, you're starting a business, or you're starting an institution, or you are making a government, you're forming a cabinet of ministers, or whatever, and you are starting to choose people. So you have a committee, let's say, that looks into the affairs of the people and looks into the human resources and tries to analyze their character, their integrity, their expertise, their piety. All of these, they are tested. Yes? After being tested, well, that person is approved and he enters into the system. Now, but once he enters into the system, then people think, okay, that's done now, you know. He has entered into the system. Now he's the minister or he's the head of a certain department. And that's done. We have done our job. As a manager, I had to just, you know, find out if he fits under those proper criteria. And now he's inside the system. Let him work the way he wants. No. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, فَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا, means that continuously, because you as a manager are making use of that person daily. So you need to be testing him daily. Does that mean that every day I need to test him? No. It means that there should be a system of checks and balances. There should be a system whereby you check the progress of the work that is happening. فَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا. Every month that passes, or every 2 months that pass, how well has this person performed? Have the aims and objectives of the institute, or the aims and objectives of that department, are they being achieved? But if you don't do that, then after 5 years, you see one work that could have been done in 5 months has not been done within 5 years. Why? Because you did not do what Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَاسْتَعْمِلْهُمْ اِخْتِبَارًا, that you need to make use of a person, but through the process of ikhtibar, that in always you need to examine and test. There should be a systems of checks and balances whereby you get to and reporting. So look at this small word of Imam Ali, how much inside it there is, you know, that there should be a system of reporting, a system of checks and balances. You need to set goals and aims and objectives for that department and then get this information. This is how, inshallah, you will be able to be successful in that work that you're managing. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Private sector activity in the Eurozone has worsened at the end of the year, raising the possibility that the region may experience a recession soon. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Financial Times has covered this story and tells us more. According to economists, lower public spending is set to curb Eurozone economic growth next year as the bloc moves into an era of budget restraint, putting pressure on rate setters to loosen monetary policy. Recently, the European Union finance ministers agreed to new fiscal rules that replace strict but hard-to-enforce budget constraints that have been suspended since the pandemic hit in 2020. The measures will phase in tighter spending curves, forcing higher debt countries to lay out plans to decrease their debt deficit and set a ceiling on annual expenditure agreed on in Brussels. Lucretia Rachlin, a professor at London Business School and former Director General of Research at the European Central Bank, the ECB, said the new rules will still be restrictive, and for countries with high debt like Italy, that is bad news. Economists expect a jarring end to almost 3 years of supportive fiscal policy in the European bloc, as the return to more restricted government spending further squeezes weak demand and activity. The Eurozone economy contracted 0.1% in the third quarter of this year, after stagnating for most of this year. Jack Allen Reynolds, an economist at Consultants Capital Economics, said the new European Union rules would be more strict by requiring high-debt countries like Italy to cut their budget deficits faster, but also more lenient in allowing countries to reduce debt levels more slowly. Some fear the shift could even mark a return to pre-pandemic situation in which the European Central Bank had to shoulder most of the burden for economic stimulus, forcing it to resort to negative interest rates and large bond purchases to ward off deflation. Recently, the European Central Bank brought forward the timing of when it expects countries to repeal support measures that were ushered in to counter the recent jump in energy and food prices, forecasting a sharp tightening of the single currency bloc's fiscal stance in 2024. The European Central Bank forecasts the overall budget deficit of the Eurozone countries would shrink from 3.1% this year to 2.8% next year. That contrasts with a much more expansionary stance in the United States, which the International Monetary Fund expects to have a budget deficit of 8.2% this year and 7.4% next year. Konstantin Veit, a portfolio manager at Investor PIMCO, said the European Central Bank may struggle to boost economic activity. Konstantin Veit said, "We might end up in a situation again where governments are not investing enough and the European Central Bank has to do more, but monetary policy ends up pushing on a string." According to Consensus Economics, economists have cut their 2024 economic growth forecast for the euro area from 1.2% at the start of the year to just below 0.5 percentage point. The European Central Bank recently cut its 2024 economic growth forecast to 0.8%, down from 1% previously. The average forecast for Germany's economic growth next year has fallen from almost 1.4% at the start of the year to below 0.4%. Many economists have cut their forecasts after recent court ruling, which Tomasz Wielodek at T. Rowe Price said would create a fiscal drag of 20 billion euros to 30 billion euros next year for the EU's largest economy. Martin Wolberg, an economist at Generali Investments, recently cut his forecast for Germany's economic growth next year to only 0.1%, warning the country's budget crisis will have a negative economic effect primarily by a hit on confidence. Martin Wolberg added, "Damping down euro area growth, it will, at the margin, increase the willingness of the European Central Bank to embark on an interest rate cut." Minister for Public Expenditure and President of the Eurogroup of Finance Ministers, Pascal Donohue, told reporters recently that the EU's recent rules were undoubtedly going to have an impact on the fiscal stance in the eurozone, which he described as restrictive in 2024. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Private sector activity in the euro area worsened at the end of the year, raising the risk that the region may experience a recession soon. Standard & Poor's Global's Purchasing Managers Index contracted for a seventh month in December, falling to 47. That defied economists' expectations of a slight uptick, though they still predicted that the gauge would remain well below the 50 level that marks expansion. Readings for both manufacturing and services showed a slump. Hamburg Commercial Bank chief economist Cyrus de la Rubia said the figures paint a disheartening picture as the eurozone economy fails to display any distinct signs of recovery. Cyrus de la Rubia added, "The likelihood of the eurozone being in a recession since the third quarter remains notably high." Recent numbers, which also showed that inflows of new business fell sharply, chime with indicators and data that suggest the region's contraction in the 3 months through to September saw a repeat in the final period of the year. Still, the European Central Bank's latest forecast, published recently, predicted a slight improvement in the period. Similar to the overall trend, separate Purchasing Managers Index for Germany and France showed the downturn worsened in the euro area's two biggest economies. German bonds extended gains and the euro fell after the figures were released. Traders added to bets on European Central Bank interest rate cuts next year after the softer data, pricing 155 basis points of monetary easing. That's down from about 150 basis points on Thursday, 21st of December. Bloomberg Economics said the survey suggests the broader picture is one of an economy still contracting that creates downside risks for our forecasts as well as the European Central Bank's forecasts and should keep market expectations for an interest rate reduction before June alive. Geopolitics, customer reluctance, and the European Central Bank's battle against inflation were cited as reasons for the subdued performance in the German economy. Standard & Poor's Global said uncertainty about the country's public finances after a landmark constitutional court ruling sparked a budget crisis may also have weighed in on economic activity. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio by your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
RIB English Radio. Herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been transmitted from Imam Muhammad Taqi al-Jawad alayhi salam. This hadith is about his son, Imam Ali al-Naqi al-Hadi. As you know, today marks the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi, also known as Imam Ali al-Naqi, alayhi salam. And on behalf of IRIB English Radio and Hadith of the Day, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners on this very grave and very sad and solemn day. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam said, "Certainly the Imam after me is my son, Ali. His command is my command. His word is my word. Obedience to him is obedience to me. And the Imama after him will rest with his son, Al-Hasan, alayhi salam." You know, many virtues have been narrated regarding Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. We would like to recite one of these today, which comes in the form of a story. A group of people from Isfahan, among whom were Abul Abbas Ahmad ibn al-Nasr and Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Alawiyah, narrated, "There was a man named Abdul Rahman in Isfahan who was a Shia. He was asked, 'Why have you accepted the Imama of Ali al-Naqi instead of anyone else from among the people of the time?' So he replied, 'I witnessed that which obligated me to believing such. I was a poor man, but outspoken and daring. So the people of Isfahan exiled me and a few others. We came to Mutawakkil to ask for justice. We were at Mutawakkil's gate when the command came to bring Ali ibn Muhammad ibn Ridha alayhi salam. I asked those present there who this man was that had been commanded to be brought there. Someone replied, 'He is an Alawi whom the Rafida believe to be their Imam.' He then said, 'Mutawakkil may have summoned him in order to kill him.' I said, 'I will not move from here until I see who this person is.' He continued, 'He came riding on a horse, and verily people were standing in a line on the right and the left of his path watching him. When I saw him, I stopped and looked at him. Love for him filled my heart, and I prayed for him in my heart for Allah to repel from him the evil of Mutawakkil. He moved through the crowd, his sight fixed on the reins of his horse, not looking around, and I was constantly supplicating for him. When he reached me, he turned his face towards me and said, "May Allah accept your supplication, lengthen your life, increase your wealth and your children." After that, we returned to Isfahan. Allah opened phases of wealth upon me so that I had to lock away in my house more than 1,000,000 dirhams, and this apart from the wealth that is outside of my house. I have been blessed with 10 sons and have reached an age in excess of 70 years. This is the reason for my faith in the Imama of this man who knew what was in my heart, and Allah granted his prayers for me." Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the virtues of Imam Ali al-Naqi alayhi salam in the words of Imam Jawad alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
This